George Washington was not the only one to have doubts about the wisdom being shown by the Confederation, its Congress, and its presidents. But his doubts existed at one end of a spectrum of doubts. And at the other end of that spectrum were the unhappy and contentious farmers of Western New England. Although the Revolutionary War had begun in New England, there had been comparatively little fighting there after 1776. That didn't mean that New Englanders were free to resume life as normal, though. New state governments had to be formed to replace the old provincial ones. A wartime economy had to be completely redirected for the usual flows of commerce. And there were soldiers to be recruited for the Continental Army and the state militias. So, like the Confederation Congress and the other states, Massachusetts resorted to paying its bills by issuing paper. However, there was so little specie in the hands of the Massachusetts government to back that paper up that the paper was soon circulating at 1/4 of its face value. In other words, presenting £20 in Massachusetts notes would get you only £5 worth of the goods you once had got for 20. By 1781, the Massachusetts notes were circulating at 1/40th of their face value. Valiantly, Massachusetts pledged to redeem all of its paper at face value, which was awful for those who had exchanged handfuls of it earlier at the depreciated value. People like discharged soldiers returning to their farms with debts to pay and nothing available to pay them with but vastly depreciated state currency. On the other hand, it was a bonanza for speculators in Boston who bought up about 80% of the Massachusetts state debt at 1/8 or 1/10 of its face value and who now stood to gain hugely if and when the state ever managed to redeem the paper. And redeeming that paper was what the Massachusetts legislature, the general court, set itself to do by taxation. In 1786, the general court decided to redeem all of the £270,000 in army notes it had issued for war purposes, and a third of the £1.25 million in consolidated notes it had printed for general purposes, and to do it by increasing taxes by over 500% and requiring payment in hard coin, in specie, British shillings, Spanish dollars, anything that would ring when dropped on a table. 10% of the revenue from these taxes would come from state impost and excise taxes. The rest would come from increases in property taxes and poll taxes, taxes which were levied on every adult male over 16 years of age. In other words, it was a taxation scheme, not unlike the one recommended by Robert Morris for the entire Confederation. Unhappily, the blow of these tax increases in Massachusetts would fall hardest on those who made their living from the land they owned, which is to say, the farmers, who made up 70% of the Massachusetts population. And the farmers were the least prepared to absorb that blow, because for the most part, few of them dealt in cash anyway, paper or specie. Colonial farming was overwhelmingly self-supporting, or subsistence farming. A typical farmer who owned between 50 and 60 acres might use 4 acres as pasture for an ox and 2 or 3 cows, another 4 acres to produce hay, and hemp and flax on 2 more. Another 4 acres would yield 70 bushels of wheat. Since the farmer needed, on a per annum basis, only about 60 bushels of flour, 200 pounds of beef, enough flax for weaving clothing, and odds and ends of potatoes and turnips and carrots, the farmer could supply a family of 5 and still have enough produce to sell for about £3, with which he could buy any manufactured commodities he fancied, or used for barter with local artisans in the rural towns. Barter was big business. A clockmaker in Shirley, Massachusetts, exchanged a clock for a cow and a calf. A shoemaker in Groton got 4 bushels of corn from Abel for 1 pair thick shoes sold to Timothy Holden. The rest of the farmer's acreage could lie fallow, or be used for some incidental crops, or left to grow as woodland to feed the winter fire. As one farmer boasted, "A farm provided me and my whole family a good living on the produce of it. Nothing to wear, eat, or drink was purchased, as my farm provided all." Money played a comparatively small part in the overall networks of exchange. The new taxes set off 2 chains of reaction. First, the requirement of paying in specie set off a desperate search for hard coin, and that usually meant calling in any IOUs or promissory notes that a farmer, a store owner, or an artisan might have accepted from other farmers. In many cases, these notes and IOUs had been accepted from the issuer, then used as collateral by the lender for other purchases, and thus set up elaborate skeins of people with paper debt who found themselves without enough specie to pay their bills. Second, the Commonwealth's tax collectors would be assessing and then collecting. And farmers who failed to find enough specie to pay their property and poll taxes would find themselves in court, faced with the auction of their farms to satisfy the taxes. The result was inevitably going to be distress. Now, that was putting it mildly. The farmer who tried to bring his produce to market to raise cash, explained James Swan, finds that every other farmer is doing likewise, and so is obliged to take up with the buyer's offer, which is totally insufficient to discharge his taxes. Since there is no family that does not want some money for some purposes, the little which the farmer carries home from market must be applied to other uses besides paying the collector's bills. The consequence is, distraint is made upon his stock or real estate. The General Court of Massachusetts and Governor James Bowdoin might have seen what was coming. In 1782, an earlier tax hike, payable in specie, had triggered an outburst in western Massachusetts, Hampshire County, led by an itinerant preacher named Samuel Ely, who threatened to chase down the collectors and close the county courts to prevent suits for debt. "Come, my brave boys," he said, "we will go to the woodpile and get clubs enough and knock their gray wigs off and send them out of the world in an instant." Ely was promptly arrested, but furious farmers under a former revolutionary captain named Reuben Dickinson descended with 600 men and released Ely from jail. Ely was eventually rearrested, but the legislature dropped any further proceedings once the public clamor had died down. Now, 4 years later, an even bigger and louder outburst was about to occur. It began, as before, in Hampshire County, when the County Court of General Sessions opened in the county seat of Northampton at the end of August 1786. When the court's 3 judges, accompanied by the county sheriff, arrived at the courthouse door, they were stopped there by an angry crowd of several hundred men, led by Captain Joseph Hines, Captain Joel Billings, and Deacon John Thompson. "Early in the morning of this day," wrote the county's historian, James Russell Trumbull, "there was collected a considerable number of persons under arms who paraded near the courthouse with a professed design to prevent this court from sitting. A committee from whom presented a petition requesting the court would not proceed to do any business." The judges tried opening the court session at the house of Captain Samuel Clark, innholder in Northampton, But there, the judges announced that all cases would be continued to the next session in November. And for the meanwhile, they adjourned without day. This was not going to play out as merely another rural Hampshire problem. The next week, the county court in Worcester, less than 50 miles from Boston, was closed down by another angry armed mob. A mob of 300 men and upwards took possession of the courthouse, though one of the judges, a Revolutionary War veteran himself, Artemus Ward of Shrewsbury, argued with them 2 hours. He got nothing for his trouble but heckling and threats. As in Northampton, so in Worcester. The Court of Common Pleas adjourned sine die, and the Court of Sessions to the 21st of November. And the trouble only threatened to snowball from there. When the Middlesex County Court of General Sessions tried to open in Concord, only 20 miles from Boston, on September 11th, 1786, Captain Job Shattuck, with several hundred men, prevented a session of the courts in Middlesex County. The judges called for the assistance of the local militia, but the militia balked, and the judges were eventually advised to leave town for their own good. 2 weeks later, when the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts tried to open its session in Springfield, Massachusetts, it took the precaution of having the Hampshire County Militia turned out in force under its commander, General William Shepherd of Westfield. The troops began to assemble on the 23rd, when about 120 of them took possession of the courthouse, and before the session of the court commenced, 1,000 or more were on the ground. But this time, their opponents had acquired still greater numbers and a leader in the form of Captain Daniel Shays. Born in 1747 in Hopkinton, Massachusetts, Shays had served in the Massachusetts militia at Bunker Hill and Ticonderoga in 1775 and was then commissioned as a captain in the 5th Massachusetts Regiment, and fought under General Horatio Gates at the Battle of Saratoga. He was singled out for recognition by the Marquis de Lafayette with the award of a presentation sword. But like so many of his fellow officers, Shays was paid only fitfully, and in 1780 he was forced to pawn Lafayette's sword and resign his commission. He simply lacked the money to keep up appearances as an officer and a gentleman. He moved to Pelham, Massachusetts, where he managed to eke out a living as a small farmer on 251 rocky and unproductive acres. By 1785, Shays was in debt to 10 different lenders. By 1786, he was already under threat of suit for taxes. He evidently did not think of himself as an insurgent, as a King Lud or Captain Swing, and he turned down an appeal from his Pelham neighbors to join in the closure of the Northampton court. But by the end of September, he could not withstand the importunity of his neighbors, and Shays was presently at the head of great numbers of people descending on Springfield with sprigs of hemlock in their hats to identify themselves. Finding that the government party were acting on the defensive, Shays sent an insolent demand to William Shepherd's protective cordon of militiamen that no civil cases should be tried except where both parties were willing. Shepherd refused, and Shays had some difficulty restraining his own men from attacking the courthouse directly. But General Shepherd was actually on the short end of this stick, since Shays' rebels prevented anyone from entering the courthouse and thus deprived the court of jurors. And at length, the court helplessly adjourned. Without a court to protect, William Shepherd irritably dismissed his militia, growling that he had not lost 8 years' hard service in the Revolution, only to see it jeopardized by a set of damned rascals who are daily threatening to cut my throat. Alarmed, Governor Bowdoin called the Massachusetts legislature into special session on September 27th in Boston. And the general court responded by offering both carrots and sticks to the insurgents, passing three different laws for easing the burdens of the people, especially for making real and personal estate a tender in discharge of executions, and an act for rendering law processes less expensive. Well, that was nice of them. But the horse had long since left the stable. When the Worcester County Court attempted to reopen its sessions on November 21st, another mob of Shaysites closed them down again. By now, Governor Bowdoin was in a panic. And so, for that matter, was the Confederation Congress. Not only had the Massachusetts militia proven a weak reed, but the Confederation maintained an arsenal at Springfield, which had been established for manufacture and storage of weapons at George Washington's direction in 1777. Let Shays get his hands on those weapons in the arsenal. 7,000 muskets, 1,300 barrels of gunpowder, even a few field pieces of artillery. And Shays' rebellion might begin to assume larger proportions than just a Western Massachusetts hissy fit. They would march directly to Boston, Shays promised, plunder it, and then to destroy the nest of devils who by their influence make the court enact what they please, burn it, and lay the town of Boston in ashes. Congress hastily authorized the recruitment of 1,340 troops, although it disguised the real purpose behind the flimsy excuse that the new recruits were needed to deal with Indian troubles in the Ohio River Valley. But Governor Bowdoin could not wait for the Confederation to come to his rescue. On November 28th, Bowdoin issued arrest warrants for five of the Shaysite leaders closest to Boston, including Job Shattuck. On January 4th, he called for the recruitment of 4,400 volunteers to put down the insurrection, privately funded by 153 wealthy Bostonians to the tune of some £6,000, and commanded by the doughty old Revolutionary War hero General Benjamin Lincoln. In 2 weeks, Lincoln had managed to whip his little army into presentable shape, and on January 19th, they all set out westwards to secure the Springfield arsenal and bring Daniel Shays to bay. Shays acted at once to beat Lincoln to the punch. But when he arrived at Springfield with between 1,500 and 2,000 men, he discovered that vengeful old General Shepard had been faster still and had occupied the arsenal on his own authority with approximately 1,200 militiamen. On January 25th, Shays and his officers planned a three-pronged assault on the arsenal, which they hoped would bluff Shepard's militiamen into surrender. But Shepard was in no mood to be bluffed. He drew up his militia in line of battle in front of the arsenal, planting two artillery pieces along the line. Shays immediately put his troops in motion and marched on rapidly near 100 yards, Shepard reported. Shepard tried to stop them by ordering the artillery gunners to fire two warning shots over the Shaysites' heads. But it had no effect on them. With the next discharge, Shepard's artillerymen fired through the center of Shays' column, and the next after that put the whole column into the utmost confusion. Shays struggled to rally them, but in vain. Shepard was ready to charge upon their rear and flanks with my infantry and the two field pieces and could have killed the greater part of the whole army within 5 minutes. But he had done enough. Four of Shays' men were dead. There was not, Shepard wrote, a single musket fired on either side. Shays, and what he could retrieve of his army, retreated northwards, 20 miles, to the village of Petersham. And there, on February 3rd, they were surprised by the appearance of Benjamin Lincoln and Governor Bowdoin's private militia. Lincoln captured 150 of them, but most of the others, including Shays, melted into the woods, heading for a sanctuary in Vermont or New Hampshire. A few made it to Canada, where they appealed to the Governor General, Lord Dorchester, for arms and supplies. Dorchester was interested in anything that made trouble for the Americans, but the Foreign Office in London was not. Shays' Rebellion was over. Shays' Rebellion touched a deep sense of unease about the stability, not only of Massachusetts, but the entire Confederation. Not only this Commonwealth, but the Union at large are in the most confused and confounded condition, wrote Samuel Lyman of Springfield. We do not yet feel that sameness or unity of interest, which is the only cement of any nation, and which is absolutely necessary to be felt in order to make us respectable and important. Still, for all the terror Shays' Rebellion had inspired, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts proved singularly cautious about turning any of the rebels into martyrs. Two rebels, John Bligh and Charles Rose, were hanged on December 6, 1787. 16 more were condemned to death, but pardoned, while 4,000 of the insurgents signed confessions and took an oath of allegiance to the Commonwealth. Shays himself petitioned successfully for a pardon from Vermont, which was granted in 1788. But he never returned to Massachusetts and died in 1825 in Sparta, New York, finally able to draw on a military pension for his Revolutionary War service. The actual impact of Shays' Rebellion was more profound the further one moved from its epicenter in western Massachusetts. Henry Knox, Washington's former artillery chief and now the Confederation's Secretary of War, wailed to Washington that Shays had sparked a pretty formidable rebellion, which had determined to overturn not only the forms, but the principles of the present constitutions. Washington's old cavalry general, Henry Lee, known as Light Horse Harry, was convinced that some of the Shaysite leaders avowed the subversion of the Confederation to be their object, together with the abolition of debts, the division of property, and reunion with Great Britain. And what was worse, in all the eastern states, the same temper prevails more or less, and will certainly break forth whenever the opportune moment may arrive. The one silver lining in the cloud, said Henry Knox, was that Shays' near success had wrought prodigious changes in the minds of men in that state respecting the powers of government. Everybody says they must be strengthened, and that unless this shall be effected, there is no security for liberty and property. In fact, the larger irony of Shays' uprising was that it had been done not in the name of republican virtue, but for the protection of what little property the Shaysites were clinging to. One of the big losers of Shays' Rebellion was Governor James Bowdoin, the governor of Massachusetts. When he came up for re-election in April of 1787, he lost by wide margins, especially in the western rural districts of Massachusetts, to John Hancock, whom we know mostly as the writer of the fancy signature on the Declaration of Independence, but who was known in Massachusetts at that point as something of a self-appointed tribune of the people. Only 77 of the 203 members of the lower house of the Massachusetts legislature were reelected. This would, as one Shaysite put it, please we poor folks, and bid goodbye to them tarnal great men that Bowdoin sent up here last winter. I believe Governor Hancock will put his negative to anything that ain't answerable to the good cause. William Shepherd was harassed for months afterwards as the murderer of brethren, and he received death threats, To let you know we have determined to kill you, I write in haste, for my anger being up to the very heavens and crying aloud for vengeance. The legislature, at least, took the hint. It cut taxes and froze actions against debtors. It cost the Commonwealth of Massachusetts economically, since Massachusetts bonds and securities fell in value by 30%. But politically, it brought at least a measure of peace. Thus, wrote the first historian of Shays Rebellion, George Minot, in 1788, thus was a dangerous internal war finally suppressed by the spirited use of constitutional power, without the shedding of blood by the civil magistrate, a circumstance which it is the duty of every citizen to ascribe to its real cause, the lenity of government. Henry Knox should have known that all this would be of small consolation to George Washington. I am mortified beyond description when I view the clouds that have spread over the brightest morn that ever dawned on a country, Washington replied to Light Horse Harry Lee. The Shaysites were all the proof he needed that civic virtue was not what Americans were interested in. If the Confederation Congress, if even the rock-ribbed Commonwealth of Massachusetts turned out to be incapable of governing, then disgruntled people would find some other way of governing. And they might not necessarily follow John Locke's path through the state of nature to the security of property. In that case, would liberty prove to be indistinguishable from suicide?